We're almost on time at 3:30. We have all members here with Senator Stevens, Dyson, and Lincoln. We do have a quorum for business. We had on the schedule Senate Bill 31, but they're not here, so we will move on down to Senate Bill 50. As soon as you lose.
He's not here either.
He's not here either. Dave is not here.
Mary was gonna.
Okay.
Well, let's see. She should be right behind me.
Senator Wagner, you want to punt for your staff here?
Okay, let's see.
You can always adjourn the meeting and go home. I'd rather do that.
She's been actually going through this. I haven't even gone through it yet, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, well, we'll go off the record. Take it easy. Senate Bill 31, since the bill sponsor's representative is here. Mr. Schmitz.
Thank you. Sorry for my tardiness. Well, a little bit, I guess I can just start out with a little bit of history. SB 31 is a bill to allow the Alaska Railroad to extend its tracks from Allison Air Force Base, where it ends right now, as far as the Canadian border. And there's another section in the bill that would allow it to explore the possibility of extending its tracks as far as the North American rail system, which right now is up in Fort Nelson, British Columbia. In the Alaska part, which is the first part of the bill, the goal is to allow the there's no money given to the railroad. It gives it the opportunity to try to find the money where it can, and we're thinking about the goal, of course, being the federal government, perhaps, or they could bond, or there's any number of things. And then state land for the corridor itself, where the tracks would go to them, fee simple title after a process is underway. I mentioned a little history. This bill was up last year. Representative James had it, and it didn't make it all the way through because there were some concerns about the corridor and the gas pipeline and that kind of thing. So Senator Cowdery reintroduced the bill again this year, and we used used the same language that was in the bill last year. And then after the transportation, or during the transportation committee, there was a dialogue between Senator Cowdery, the administration, which is in favor of this bill, because of the work that Senator Murkowski did in Washington, D.C. on the Rails to Resources Act, which is kind of another issue. And then with DNR and with the Department of Transportation, or with DNR rather, and then with the railroad. So the idea was to come up with language that everybody could be happy with, so that some of the issues about how they would get the land and under what circumstances and what land, et cetera, would be answered. In the bill itself, this was done to some extent in if you look on page 2, beginning with line 4, it lists a series of parameters that the railroad would have to look at. And then there's some people online that I've asked to be there from the Alaska Railroad. Rather than me try to explain it and have them re-explain it the right way, they can go into the actual details of how they worked, and why they came to the language that they did to reach some of these compromises. I prepared a packet. In addition to the packet that you have, there's some background material in the black folders. There's some maps in there, which I think you may find helpful. They show the actual route from Eielson to the Canadian border, and then there's a couple of maps that show the overall, and you can see where the British Columbia Railroad goes to the north. So the actual gap between where that would have to be filled is about 1,000 miles. I can go into, there's the overall philosophy behind doing this is because Alaska and Governor Murkowski has made this a cornerstone, and Senator Cowdery is a strong believer in this concept that in order for Alaska's economy to grow, we have to have better transportation infrastructure. And there are things that rails do well that trucks don't do, and vice versa. In other words, rails are very good for carrying heavy bulk items over long distances very cheaply. Senator Cowdery is also believes in this in the concept of building the rail connection because of the gas pipeline. And in order to efficiently carry up the steel for the pipe that would be needed, 80-foot joints and a 54-inch pipe, 1 1/4-inch thick, their trucks can't carry that load. So rail can do that, and there's an opportunity perhaps to build the railroad and the gas pipeline together, so that one can use the other. Anyway, in the black book there's some reports that have been given over a period of time on tourism, on the engineering, and on the geology. You know, the railroad corridor where it goes through is some of the richest mineral land in Alaska, as well as on the other side in the Yukon Territory. And there's a geological formation called the Tintina Trench, which is particularly rich in platinum group metals, in gold, and other minerals like that. So I guess with that, I can just take questions and probably just direct you to whoever's online that is there that knows about the legal and how the language was changed from the original bill to answer some of these questions and concerns.
Okay. Let's see, who we have online is, looks like Phyllis Johnson, Wendy Linscoot, Pat Gamble, and James Mastigan. We'll let the record reflect that Senator Dyson and Stevens joined us a while ago, and as Senator Lincoln. Who's the expert on this? Wants to testify about the changes between the regarding changes from that last committee to this committee? But are you suggesting that we should have some discussion about what the original bill to the transportation changes are?
I can do that. We can start with that. The original bill was more basic. It just talked about giving the state land fee simple. Where the issue came up was over a 500-foot corridor, or because the railroad wants to have the 500 feet for purposes of safety. DNR's concern was, is do we want to lock up that much land? Is that necessary, you know, entirely? So they've come up with some compromises. There are some practical issues. For example, let's say where the railroad might go through a community like Delta or Salta. You know, people may not want to, you don't need to give up the whole 500 feet, then you don't have to. So this gives some flexibility when the corridor is delineated. And there's a kind of a process that would go through before any of that state land was given over. They'd have to actually be at the position of beginning construction. So nothing's being authorized until they have the money lined up and this kind of thing.
What is the current right-of-way on the existing railroad?
I believe it's 500 feet where it is. That's always been, it's kind of the standard, but it may be less. I think it varies from 100 feet up to 500 feet in different places when it goes through Anchorage and when it goes through the canyon and that kind of thing.
Yeah, is there somebody from the railroad that can answer that question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Pat Gamble, President of the Alaska Railroad, and I do have Phyllis Johnson here from our legal department. I also have Bob Loeffler and Joe Joyner from DNR, so they're here also to answer DNR questions.
Okay. What's the current average right-of-way? It's not 500, is it?
No, sir. It's 200 feet right-of-way is the current average.
So why do you want so much land?
That was the nature of the compromise when we talked to DNR and brought up the idea. This was a showstopper issue, was last year, too. And we brought up the idea that the state wanted a corridor for transportation, communications, and movement, possible pipeline. The railroad wanted an exclusive right-of-way for control of the rail line like we have all up and down our normal rail line. And the compromise was, well, then what's the possibility of surveying a 500-foot corridor for the state and within it embedding a 200-foot right-of-way like we have everywhere else for the railroad? And that is the basis upon which we work together.
If you got a 200 or 500 foot right of way, and you're getting subsurface rights as well, according to this bill, and the rights of eminent domain, that has a pretty big impact on, say, private landowners that you're going across. So how do they feel about it? Is anybody?
To correct that last statement, it would be a 500 foot state border within which there would be a 200 foot railroad right of way. And we don't have those subsurface rights. I'd like to let DNR talk about that a little bit, if that would be okay, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, well, it does say in the bill on page 3, line 26, that the state shall convey the state's entire interest in the land. I would assume that would be subsurface.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
This is where it says on page 28.
Who's this, please?
I'm sorry. My name is Bob Leckler. I'm the director of DNR's Division of Mining, Land, and Water.
Thank you, Bob.
And we convey the state's entire interest, reserving to the state the interest required by AS 3805-125. And 3805-125 is the subsurface interest.
Okay.
So, in fact, we reserve oil and gas, minerals, all of those things that go with the mineral estate.
All right.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Senator Elton.
I just wondered which, are we looking at Quebec, version Quebec?
Yes. That's the bill before us, it's transportation conversion. Senator Elton?
Thanks, and I'm not sure if this is for the general or for Mr. Leffler, but the draft sectional analysis says that DNR will retain any revenues arising from the use of the lands. I would assume that any revenues would also include fiber optic or other things that are now generating revenue for the railroad.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Elton, the way the bill works is before the railroad is ready to construct, then in fact DNR remains the land manager and gets people across and retains the revenues. Once the railroad constructs, is ready to construct a portion, then on that portion, say to Fort Greeley or to Delta or whatever the portion is, then they get the portion of those revenues that are in their right of way. So we retain the revenues while we manage the land, and when we transfer the management authority for that portion, the revenues for that portion of the land go with it.
And if I could follow up, Mr. Chair, that does that include the subsurface rights then?
No, sir. We don't transfer the subsurface rights. We retain them.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Okay. Were there any other questions in the committee?
Chairman?
Oh, Senator Seekins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if anyone from the looking at this transportation corridor and anticipating that there could be some tie-in with a gas pipeline. What, you know, we've got a 54-inch high-pressure gas pipeline within 300 feet of a railroad. Are there safety issues involved here?
You don't want to have a train wreck.
No.
I'm sorry, I was being a little flippant.
Or is that considered within the boundaries of safety?
Mr. Gamble or somebody else?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not exactly an expert on what the safety radius is from that pipeline, but that was one of the reasons why that 500-foot corridor was attractive, because we have the opportunity to try and place that gas pipeline as best we can to ensure safety, and I think there's still some more work would need to be done as we look the entire route over to see where we can maintain that safety buffer or in what geographical conditions it might be compromised, that we might have to look at some other sort of engineering solution or physical solution to the problem. And I'm afraid I don't have all the answers on that one right now.
Well, I know on section, let's see, on page 4, line 15, it kind of delineates that. It says that if the corporation provides survey alignment to the department may not authorize construction of a natural gas pipeline within a 200-foot wide corridor centered on the survey alignment unless the department does not find a feasible and prudent alternative for the route of the pipeline. I would assume those are safety issues, but so you don't have how big are train wrecks when train wrecks happen? Do they go more than 200 feet? I mean, I suppose they could if things are going fast and.
It's possible that things are going fast. Generally, the kind of country we're talking about, just like the rest of the rail line, it has places where it's flat and fast and places where we slow down considerably. If you look at an 80-foot car length and the way they accordion out, 200 feet is probably on the outside edge of where most train derailments
not to change the subject, but boy, I was in Florida here last year, 2 years ago, and I was amazed how fast those trains go down there. Of course, they don't have Frosties. And, man, they were screaming through town. I mean, just flying 70 miles an hour through the residential areas. I was like, whoa. I'd forgotten. I used to live next to the tracks in Florida. Anyway, Senator Seekers.
One other question, and it may be here, and I may have missed it, but if we have a 500-foot corridor, and 200 feet of that is dedicated to the railroad, I'm assuming that it would be on one side or the other instead of it down the middle. Because 200 feet out of the middle would kind of make the rest of it kind of useless. Is that addressed in here that I missed?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Seekins, I think the 500 feet is for a couple of reasons. One is so that when they actually get to construction and move the railroad place around a little bit, and second is so DNR can retain some additional land as a transportation corridor for other complementary uses. You would imagine that the railroad would, in fact, move around a little bit as they actually get towards construction. And so then we would, after the construction is done, we could certainly, of course, adjust the corridor, and any remnants that were unusable, we would probably drop and turn back to general domain state land.
And then primarily, Mr. Chairman, my concern was there that if it's going to be a transportation corridor that would include that natural gas pipeline, that there be that safety buffer there somehow or another.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Seekins, I believe the natural gas pipeline will have a separate right-of-way. This is not expected to be the right-of-way in all cases for voting.
But it doesn't rule it out.
Right.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Okay. Well, that's what you pay those engineers big money to figure out, huh? Senator Lincoln and Senator Elton?
I want to go back, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I want to go back to the subsurface rights on page 3, last paragraph. This says subject to the valid existing rights. I'm trying to unravel this. If the state, I would guess, uses eminent domain on regional or village lands, then they convert that over to the railroad. I mean, I'm not sure where it's, you know, the valid existing rights, then if it's eminent domain, then is the valid existing rights to the state or to the railroad for subsurface if they're buying private lands?
Mr. Loeffler?
Senator Lincoln, Mr. Chairman, we can't convey what we don't own. So our conveyance to the railroad doesn't include any rights that we don't own. So this is our conveyance is subject to valid existing rights. If we own the we also reserve the subsurface. Where the subsurface is owned by the state and there's a surface right, maybe a corporation, one would assume that they would buy the surface right and the state would still retain the subsurface. I cannot imagine them having a reason to acquire the subsurface unless, for example, it was a placer miner who was using it, who in fact they, like some highways sometimes do, they need to buy out to get out of the way. But those are really the situations. But if it's state land and state subsurface, we retain it.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I might, then what I'm hearing is that if I'm specifically thinking of the Native Corporation lands who own the surface and subsurface, you're saying that the state or the railroad would have no need for that subsurface, so they would purchase only the surface rights and leave the subsurface rights with the private owner?
That would be my expectation. Of course, what the railroad purchases, they're probably a better one to answer that.
I would suggest that we don't want them to do any open mine pit mining, you know, underneath the railroad. But you know, but you know, this department here or this section here, Senator Lincoln, it says the Department of Natural Resources shall convey the state's entire interest, and so it's silent on the like private property, in particular, you know, native lands.
Well, because it's the valid existing rights.
Right. And so they, you know, as you know, the native lands have the subsurface rights or conveyed. So, and I guess the question at hand might be, you know, any eminent domain would be for the surface rights only that they might need on this with some native land?
What is that?
Okay. Seems to me it would be in the main corporation's interest to power land owner. I'd look probably pretty favorably at having a railroad getting across it, and then all of a sudden you got a whole bunch of land opened up to you. You know, maybe it might be off limits for other things, but anyway, it's hard to say case by case basis, but it'd be a heck of a deal. You got a whole bunch of land, has to build a road on it, railroad or otherwise. So, okay, does anybody else have any questions? Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I think this is a question for Mr. Loeffler. Again, on page 4, beginning on line 20, there are a couple of phrases in here that would suggest to me that the first priority is a railroad and the second priority would be a gas pipeline. Beginning on line 20, it says, if the corporation provides a survey alignment to the department may not authorize construction of the natural gas pipeline within the 200-foot wide corridor centered on a survey alignment, unless. And then further along, it says, the department shall consult with the corporation before authorizing construction of a natural gas pipeline in order to minimize effects on a potential rail route. It would seem to me that if I were a person, and I would suggest right now that I am a person, who would prioritize a gas pipeline above a railroad extension.
For the record.
It would seem to me that that language could be problematic.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Elton, I don't prioritize a railroad above a gas pipeline. And really, that really wasn't the intent, and I hope that that is not the operation of this section. This, what we try to do is precisely to put language in that would ensure complementary action and avoid conflict to the best we could. Now, this language is not about the pipeline, it's about the railroad, so it all modifies the railroad. But here's how we think it works. If there is an existing application or right-of-way, that is a valid existing right, that gets dropped from, it doesn't get conveyed to the railroad. If we've already identified a 500-foot corridor, and a pipeline says, well, geez, we're really ready to go through there, then what we say is, well, the pipeline, typically, railroads are more topographically limited. They have trouble going up hills, things like that. And in fact, a pipeline. So what we do is we say, look, railroad, we're going to give you a chance to stake the center line. You know where it's really most important for you. And then we'll make that decision. And we make that decision in the best interest of the state. And if we can find a feasible and prudent alternative, and that is reasonably general language, which gives us the flexibility to take economics and the best interests of the state into account. So our expectation is not that this gives a priority to the railroad, but it does require a consultation with a railroad. And of course, the consultation would go the other way as well with any applicants, but this language was really directed to the railroad. I hope that answers the question.
It does. I mean, the answer that I'm hearing is that that's not your expectation. Have you had your attorneys look at that language?
We had our attorneys look at that language, not with this very specific question in mind. I can certainly do that and get back to you.
But Mr. Chair, I'd be comfortable if their attorneys did do that.
Yeah, and I actually had highlighted that section in the bill myself. With some kind of concerns about that. So
I will have that done. With all speed, Mr. Chairman.
Well, standard MO in our committee is to take a look at a bill, and unless it's really clean, hold it over. And so we'll probably plan on doing that with this one, to take a look at that. And any, is there any other questions? Senator Wagner?
I just got one. This question goes back to one of the primary reasons I keep, or somebody keeps telling me we're extending this railroad, because when we build the gas pipeline, it's going to be 80-foot sections. In the first place, I've asked a couple of the companies that would be major companies involved in construction of the pipeline. They say it's going to be 40-foot sections. And the question they sent back to me the other day was, are we going to build the railroad to the North Slope so we can handle 80-foot sections? That was just kind of a tongue-in-cheek remark. So I think one of the things we're using to justify building this railroad is really not set in concrete yet. And I'd like to see something from one of the companies that plan to construct this pipeline saying just exactly what a joint of pipe is going to be when it comes to this gas pipeline. And if it's not 80 foot, and if we can handle it by truck, why are we using that for justification for the railroad, to build a railroad to handle pipe that may not ever be handled by a railroad in the first place? I mean, it's kind of a convoluted question when it comes down to it.
I think that the point of the Senator Cowdery, we talked about this, is that not that there's, you know, a guarantee that it's going to be 80-foot joints, but the way it was explained to me, obviously it's when the pipeline's built, it's going to be pennies on the dollar in terms of competitiveness and with other natural gas around the world. With 80-foot sections that were manufactured and then brought up, there's half the number of welds as if you had 40-foot sections or joints. So if it could be done that way, that could be the difference between putting the pipeline in and not putting it in for strength. And
I just, the other question I would say is, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if anybody can roll an 80-foot joint of pipe right now. That's a big piece of pipe.
That I don't know.
On that point?
On that point.
Okay.
Of course, I happened to be there when, and so was Senator Lincoln, in the interior when they built the oil pipeline. And at that time, the joints were 40-foot joints that were brought into Fairbanks, double jointed, and hauled by truck in 80-foot lengths to construct the oil pipeline. And there was additional cost that went with that double jointing process. If they could have, now I would imagine that with someone that had 2,000 miles of pipe to build, that they'd find a way to get the technology to do that. But it is tremendous additional cost in that double jointing, and a safety factor in trying to take a high pressure pipe and do field welds to produce that. So, but I would, from a standpoint of, I'm in favor of a railroad extension for a number of reasons. One of them is just for commerce. I mean, there's absolutely no way in the world that we should not try to do our best to connect to the lower 48 states by railroad in terms of commerce and national defense, resource development of many different types. To have an in-state railroad system now with both ends of the railroad virtually in the state, it does help us to a degree, but I don't think it gives us the flexibility that we need to, or that we should have as a state. So I'm in favor of the concept. Whatever I have to use to find the rationale to get there, I'll try to find. But I think it's important and it's vital to our future that we try to find a way to connect with the lower 48 states and with Canada as well. You know, as time goes forward, rather than depending simply on over-the-water transportation for goods to and from the state of Alaska and over the highway as well. And so I think it's vital that we move forward with this concept for whatever reason. I'll develop the rationale, but I support the project simply because I feel that it's vital for our future. But I do know the tremendous expense that was involved in that double jointing process, and I watched it happen daily within half a mile of where I worked. And if they could, I'd like to see that too, because it would cut the cost down. And every dollar that you can take out is a chance that we'll get that pipeline built to get our product to market sooner rather than later.
I, personally think if we're going to wait for a railroad to be built before a gas line is, that we're in trouble.
No, I agree. Right. I agree. But I think it's a just one of those things that I think we need to move forward on. We need to find a way to get this right away. If that's what the first step is in the process, we need to be able to tell someone where there's a right away for a railroad that'll connect and work with the Canadians to do likewise and to do it expeditiously.
So I take it you're in support of the bill.
I am, regardless of the rationalization.
Mr. Chairman, maybe this was answered on the day I missed last week, but have we received anything from the Canadian government that they're supportive of this?
Richard?
Well, in the packet, there's some resolutions that are from the Yukon communities and from Penwar, which is, I know, actively involved with Canada, and but so I tried to include a few of those just to.
Senator Dyson, do you have a comment?
Yeah, I was over a week ago was in Yukon, and they are very actively in favor of it, and that's part of the reason we added a bit to the bill there to make sure that as the Canadians are considering what route on their side of the border, that we make sure that we do the best we can to make sure that the two routes come together. And this huge trench of very mineral-rich ground extends across the border. It kind of runs northwest, southeast, or a little flatter than that. So that's absolutely true, and it's also true in British Columbia. And if it was necessary, I didn't want to take the time, I could get resolutions from both governments. I don't think it's necessary.
Well, I think that brings me to a question I have, another area I highlighted when I was reading the bill. On page 6, line 9 through 12, says the corporation may acquire lands or interest in lands in Canada as the corporation considers appropriate for development, construction, operation, and extension of Alaska Railroad to connect to the North American Railroad System. So I guess I'm kind of puzzled why the Alaska Railroad Corporation would want to acquire interest. I mean, they can't do it by eminent domain in Canada, I wouldn't think. I would think maybe the Canadian government would do that. But so why are we... Maybe that's a question for the railroad or the bill sponsor, Richard.
Well, this was talked about when the bill was done originally last year. It was just to the Canadian border, and then in discussions that went on, the goal is to connect the railroad. You know, to make the rail connection. There's no purpose in going just to to the border and stopping. So, Representative James at that time had the idea of why not just extend it, just authorize the railroad to look into it. If they raise bonds or if the Ted Stevens gives them an extra $1 billion and they can go in as a corporation, and the Canadians want to give them a right of way or allow them to obtain one, then it would be no different really than, let's say, the White Pass Railroad, which is Canadian, obtaining its right of way in the United States to connect Skagway with the top of the mountain there. So it's just
currently done.
I don't know, I can't give you specifics, but I know that Canadian Railroads, I believe the CN owns like Burlington Northern or and tracks from American Railroads go up into Canada and vice versa, that are specifically owned.
Yeah, but do Canadian Railroads own the right of ways in the United States and vice versa?
I can't answer that for sure, but I would imagine so.
They're
private corporations, not the, I don't know if the Canadian government does, but the corporations do.
Yeah. Well, maybe somebody from the railroad could answer that. Well, why do you, Mr. Gamble, why do you need, are you supportive of this language, and do you anticipate acquiring land and interest in land in Canada to expand the railroad to Lower 48?
Mr. Chairman, I like you, understood that language to offer within this bill the flexibility of the eventuality of having to deal with that other side of the border in some way as yet quite unforeseen. So my answer to you right this moment is, as we look at this, no, we have no concrete plans to go acquire land in Canada. We recognize the language, as was mentioned, Jeanette James talked to us about the flexibility. I would say we support is just the acknowledgement of what it's there for.
Senator Seekins?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I could envision a lot of different ways that a railroad might want to acquire land or interest in land, simply in terms of support for the railroad. They may need to have office space for the administration of the railroad between the lower 48 states and Alaska. They may need to, depending on what kind of maintenance agreements might be set up between the Canadian Railroad and the Alaska Railroad, have to have housing or warehouse space or other storage space to be able to accommodate what those future needs might be. So I think it's wise to have the May in there, even though down the road we may have to address how they get the money to do that.
Okay. Well, does anybody else have any questions? Let's maybe see if anybody else wants to testify. Mr. Campbell, we've been mostly asking questions, and Mr. Loeffler, do you have any specific testimony, or are you there to answer questions?
No, Mr. Chairman, the department supports the bill, and I have no other testimony unless you really desire some.
Mr. Loeffler?
Yes, sir. Did you hear what I...
Oh, that was you? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
I don't have X-ray vision. I can't tell who's talking.
My apologies, sir.
Mr. Gamble, do you have any testimony?
Mr. Chairman, I would just say that from a strategic point of view, as the railroad looks at this project all the way to the border, we have a different view of the Fairbanks to Delta area than we do from Delta to the border. There are some possibilities in that first section to get this started that may be an interesting way to begin to look at how we would fund the operations and maintenance of the railroad by hooking up to the requirement to move goods and services back and forth from Fairbanks to Delta. That's a separate discussion on its own, and one that I'd be happy to have at another time in another place that we throw some ideas around. When you get beyond that and go all the way out to the border, I think some of the comments that were made by the committee earlier, the railroad would agree with those, that this does offer the potential to get at the kind of thing that the current administration has said they want to pursue in terms of development. Development is in the mission of the railroad. That's what we're here for. And so we stand ready when the time and conditions are right. And as you all decide to send us forward on this project, we will make it work. And we stand behind that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I think it's important to be visionary with the direction the state's going with policy, and certainly is visionary. I guess I have one question for Senator Lincoln, representing. We haven't heard anything from the Native corporations or the corporations generally supportive of this that will be affected. There's Tetlin and a few others out there.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I did talk with, and I won't name the individuals that I spoke with about their feeling on this, and they felt it was a little premature, and I can't speak for everyone, but it was a little premature to respond to or comment on this bill until it gets a little bit further along. That maybe at the time that the railroad is talking about what the corridor is, that at that time that they would chime in.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, you've been talking to them. Senator Elton.
Mr. Chair, this is a really naive question, and perhaps Senator Seekins may know the answer, or maybe Senator Wagner. Does the Railroad Corporation pay property taxes to the organized boroughs through which they pass?
What does they do? No.
It's government property. In fact, private citizens don't have eminent domain because it's that quasi government private slash they have certain benefits of government, and one of them is it's government property, basically state property. That's why we can taketh and giveth.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I know an awful lot more about the Marine Highway system than I do the railroad system.
I think some of my constituents in the Denali Borough would like to be able to collect some tax on it.
And in fact, Mr. Chair, that's why I asked the question. I mean, a portion of that area is, there is a suggestion that it leave the unorganized borough and join the organized portion. But this would not be taxable property for
I'd like to add one thing that just came up with an earlier part of the conversation, and it may be important to just to have this kind of on the record, just for everyone's information. It's not necessarily heavy or anything, but the when it comes to the land itself and the corridor, there is already an existing, not a corridor, but a right-of-way that goes back to, I believe, statehood or even earlier. The Army surveyed a rail route in the 1940s, and in the statutes, there is a rail corridor from the border to Fairbanks. So in other words, when it comes to questions, I think, of eminent domain and other things, if someone has property, there still is a right-of-way. It's undefined, but there is a railroad right-of-way that goes through there somewhere. It's never been set. I don't think there's a center line, but it is in statute. So it isn't anything new, this coming in. This just takes a little further down the road toward defining it. In other words, it's kind of like making a decision on where it's actually going to go and helping that process along.
I would assume there'd have to be an EIS and all that other stuff done too as well.
Right.
Okay, well, let's look at that. We had some questions about that language on page 4, 15 through 26. And other than that, I don't think there are any other problem areas in the bill. We'll kind of play around with that and get some questions answered about that. And we can get those either resolved or whatever. We can move it out next committee hearing, as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you.
Let's take a brief lease.
Yeah.
Another issue for us.
You're right.
Let's go back on the record. We're on the record. They will know what I'm doing. Okay, let's bring it to order, please. We have before us now, we're going to take up Senate Bill 151, Act Relating to the Regulation of Natural Gas Pipelines. And let's see here. Who do we have to testify? Aunt Mary, of course, I knew that. Welcome back, Mary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Jackson. I'm staff to Senator Tom Wagner, the prime sponsor of this bill. And Mr. Chairman, should I just go right into it?
Sure.
Thank you. This bill is truthfully a housekeeping measure. In 2000, the legislature, the legislature amended the Alaska Pipeline Act. And in there, we stuck in this term, North Slope, because at that time, that was the only natural gas pipeline that we ever saw on the horizon. We didn't anticipate another pipeline to come along. Since then, another pipeline has come along, and in fact, it's the only one that we have, and it's on the Kenai Peninsula. It's the Kenai Kachemak pipeline. We call it the KKPL. It was initially going to go from the Kachemak Bay area back to Kenai. What they drilled down in that the far end, the far southern end of the peninsula, didn't pan out. So it actually now goes from Nanilchik up to the Kenai area. I am personally very much aware of the pipeline. I live a mile from the origin of it at Marathon, who are very good neighbors, if I may say so. It starts right there and it goes to Nanilchik. It's underway right now. It's being constructed right now, and that's why there's an immediate effective date on the bill. What happened is they went to the RCA to ask for the authority to provide for their carriage and the pipeline, and the RCA said, well, it just says North Slope Natural Gas Pipeline, and we're not frankly sure whether or not we can do that. So this bill takes out North Slope and leaves it Natural Gas Pipeline. So it's throughout the state of Alaska. And that's why it is a housekeeping measure. There are people in, I believe, online from Marathon to speak to how they're going to go about doing it, but it's a pretty straightforward bill.
Okay.
I'm sorry, you know, Mr. Chairman, if I might, one more thing, just I would direct your attention to the fiscal note. You notice that there are two fiscal notes here, from the RCA, it's zero, and from the DNR, Department of Natural Resources, is indeterminate, but it's very clear the last line on page two of that note says, for the Kenai-Kachemak pipeline, these dynamics are unlikely, as only 63% of the line's total capacity has been contracted for. And that's why it's an indeterminate.
For the record, I have to beg to differ a little bit that it's a housekeeping matter, because we have common carrier pipelines in the state, which I think the theory of, you know, we made the exception for the gas line to Lower 48 because in that case the owners were going to, or the producers were going to own the pipeline, and that was all kind of by contract and open seasons and this kind of thing. I guess, you know, I have some concerns that if we shift that policy away from common carrier pipelines, and all of a sudden it could have the unintended consequences of inhibiting development of, because if you got the only way to get your gas there, the guys that that own the pipeline control what gas is in there, and by golly, they control the open seasons based on about when their development is going to come online, and everybody is kind of out, left out, then it might have the effect of locking up some resources and stranding some gas, and all of a sudden we have stranded gas, you know, because the guys that own the pipeline or own the gas on the pipeline. So, you know, those are my concerns. So I, with all due respect, I don't see it as a housekeeping measure at all.
Through the chair, I certainly do understand your concerns, and that actually was discussed. The other alternative, of course, is to put KKPL into the body of this language. So it says North Slope and KKPL, because it's the one pipeline that we're really talking about here. It's a 30-mile pipeline. And right now we're prohibited.
What if there's other gas, you know, discovered? You know, there's shallow gas potential in Homer, and for the electric, you know, nobody I know is doing anything down there. But there is, I don't know if there, I think there are shallow gas leases down there, I've been told. And so they might be, whoever has those leases, and I don't even know who has the leases, but somebody's got them, I think. I'll check with DNR. But I guess I just have some concerns that if we do this, it's going to lock out and maybe discourage some other development. So anyway, that's what I could be wrong. Somebody prove me wrong. I'm open-minded. But.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I'm looking for the notes. This is from the House Resources Committee, where it was reiterated that, and I will find it, that Forest Oil, here it is, Mr. Schaffman, who is with Marathon, noted conversations he'd had with several smaller producers, such as Aurora Gas, Forest Oil, and Evergreen. He talked about a letter of support from Aurora Gas stating that it was very much favored, that they very much favored the expansion of the infrastructure to help them, as a smaller producer, get access to the markets with their gas. He said he was given permission by Forest Oil Corporation to say it had looked at the bill and had no problems with it. Mr. Schaffman noted that his initial conversations with Evergreen seemed favorable, but that he had yet to see anything final from them.
And I haven't, for the record, I haven't heard from him either. But, Senator Elton?
Mr. Chair, I'm learning on these issues, but my understanding is if this bill doesn't pass, the only company allowed to use the pipeline would be Marathon, because they can't contract for firm or interruptible service, so it would only be their gas that moves through the pipeline?
I think, through the chair, Mr. Chairman, I believe Marathon is online. I think there's someone from Marathon. There's supposed to be someone from Marathon online who could probably better answer that directly. I don't want to speak for the company.
Yeah, Mr. Chopin is available, but my understanding, and maybe is that maybe I'm wrong, but my understanding is that if we don't pass this, then it's a common carrier pipeline. So anybody that has gas, if, for example, there's more gas than the pipeline can handle, they prorate the amount of gas that goes into the line. So, you know, and I guess if you have a field where you've, you know, the difference between that is that they can contract. What they're trying to do here is contract the amount of gas that goes through, whether or not you use it. So if somebody else comes along later on, they don't have to be allowed into the pipeline. So
that would be I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. That would be regulated then by the RCA on whose gas goes into the common carrier pipeline?
That's correct.
This is Mr. Shoff on the line. Would it be appropriate for me to chime in at this point?
Yeah, go ahead, because my knowledge is, you probably have enough knowledge to be dangerous on this. Go ahead.
Well, I appreciate the chance to speak. My name is Ben Shoffman. I'm employed by Marathon Oil Company in the Anchorage office. I'm also vice president of KKPL. KKPL is jointly owned by Marathon and Unocal. I provided some information that I hope the committee has access to relating to the background of this bill. And if it would be appropriate, I could speak to generally what the bill will do, what it won't do, and address some of the questions I've heard come up directly. Would that be appropriate, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, if you could for now, just keep to the questions that we've got, of course.
At the moment, the modifications we're talking about to the Pipeline Act are in the common carrier section of that legislation. So all this would be doing is allowing, under the common carrier section of that, for a pipeline to offer both firm and interruptible service. However, that full offering of service is still under the purview of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. It is under their authority to ensure that the process and that access to that pipeline is fair and balanced, that there is no favoritism shown to one party or another. They furthermore, in the event they find that people are being excluded, have the ability to direct the pipeline to expand capacity to make room for others who want to commit gas to ship. What we have found in Alaska, to be quite honest, is that the pipelines have been mostly built by producer affiliates, and that's because they're about the only ones with the capital or the incentive to do so. Without the ability to know that there is business to be had, gas to be shipped in this case, it's very difficult for someone who doesn't have an interest to build that pipeline. But what we actually see happen is as pipelines are built, it spurs investment activity, both by majors and by independents. The letter we have in support of this from Aurora Gas very much speaks to that. There's one particular sentence that says, Aurora Gas would not avoid exploring and developing acreage in the vicinity of producer-owned pipelines. However, Aurora can and would substantially discount the value of exploring, developing acreage with no infrastructure whatsoever. I think actually the question that's at hand, I believe the pipeline would spur investment, and rather than shutting out smaller independents, they seem to say that they will look for gas where there's infrastructure. And furthermore, that RCA has the ability to be sure the process is executed fairly. And if they find that people are being excluded, to ensure that extra capacity is built.
All right, Senator Seekins.
Mr. Chairman, I've already gone through a lot of review on this on Labor and Commerce Committee. I came to a point where I began to understand that at least in my understanding, and let me see if I'm correct, that when I know I have a gas field that can produce a certain amount of gas and I want to sell that gas, I can get a firm commitment to get that transferred through this pipeline. And that's non-interruptible gas. In other words, they've committed to continue to for that to go down through that pipeline. But if I have a gas field that has some potential and I don't know what that potential is, and I do have some, but I don't know how great it is, I could contract at least on an interruptible basis to be able to get my gas to market if there's capacity within that line to do so, which would give me kind of the opportunity to
to get started in the production of my field as I tried to find out what its parameters were. And if at a later time I were to find out that the parameters of that field were great enough to be able to overcome the capacity of this pipeline, then I have the option of either having that an interruptible contract and going building my own pipeline, or finding some other way to get that gas to market. But it's not on a firm 100% commitment basis. Now, am I correct on that?
To a point, they can also increase the carrying capacity of the line with additional compression too.
Right, if they get it up to that capacity. I know there's not an unlimited capacity. There's a point where you can't go beyond. But at least it allows me to get my product into that market stream on an interruptible basis. Because nothing has infinite capacity, there comes a point where if I'm large enough, I can go build my own pipeline.
Well, you know, maybe we should, you know, we've got a number of people who want to test. Well, we have some people who want to testify and people who answer some questions, but I forgot where to go here. We've got RCA on. Some questions for RCA. Nobody else does. Is Jim Strandberg here?
Yes, I am here, sir.
Mr. Strandberg, I think Mr. Schaufman, said that RCA has the ability to get gas that's in the line that currently isn't contracted. You know, in Alaska, we don't currently have any pipelines offering firm transportation service, and we also don't have any regulation of open seasons. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. We currently do not have a regulation that speaks to the open seasons process, sir.
So, and that's by virtue of the fact that the pipelines are either a utility or a common carrier. Is that correct?
That's correct. Currently, we have two gas pipelines in operation. One is the Beluga pipeline, and the other one is the pipeline network that NSTAR uses, Alaska Pipeline Company pipeline. Those are both certificated under a different statute, under the public utility statute.
Right. Okay. So, do you intend to make regulations in these areas if we have these firm offering or these pipelines offering firm transportation? So, basically, to regulate open seasons, or so future pipelines and shippers would know what the rules of the road are.
Well, I think that we would need to look at that. Certainly, we have the ability to create regulations through our own motion or through a petition, and it's not exactly clear at this point in time that we immediately need open season regulations. But if parties, pipeline companies, see a need for that, they can certainly petition us, and we would get involved in a regulation project.
And we don't need them now because we don't have any pipelines built that require them, so open season really isn't an issue, correct?
That's correct, and a lot of it has to do with the responsibility of the company conducting conducting their offerings. I believe, in fact, there were open seasons on the KKPL project, and they did submit those to us, and we did consider those in that particular docket.
If the only guys were at the table were the guys with the gas, though, right? So, suppose a producer-owned pipeline company purchased all the available capacity on a line, even if they don't need it in the near term to serve final customers. Do you have the authority to require that firm capacity to be released to a party that needs it now?
Senator, we feel we do have that capability under the existing statute. We regard the proposed contract carriage statute language to embed itself in the overriding common carrier language of the Alaska Pipeline Act. We feel we have flexibility to even with these changes, to regulate in the public interest.
Okay, if an independent shipper wanted you to order a capacity expansion and but a producer-affiliated pipeline doesn't want to make that expansion, which party would have the burden of proof in proceeding for RCA?
Typically, I guess that's kind of a difficult question. We have to take a look at the specific circumstances to establish where the burden of proof lies. Some of the considerations in setting burden of proof is who has the information, number one. Number two, for example, if it is a utility that's required to prove something is in the public interest, then they would have the burden of proof.
Okay. So it's somewhat ambiguous who has it, huh?
And also the moving party. There's a couple of kind of rules of thumb that we employ here, but again, you have to look at each specific circumstance.
All righty. Does anybody else have any questions for RCA? Do you have a position on the bill?
We have. We take no position other than to note that there's a zero fiscal note, and we feel we can certainly accommodate the statute changes within our current statute.
Senator Lincoln?
Yes. On the second fiscal note, I just wanted it clarified. Let me see. This is from DCED, and the analysis second page, it says, there are no fiscal impacts on RCA for this bill. And then it goes, however, it is expected that where producers elect to own and operate a pipeline, which is allowed, the contract carriage with service under these statutory terms will be proposed to RCA in a pipeline tariff filings. Could you explain what that is saying?
All right. Well, through the chair, Senator Lincoln, perhaps the however may be slightly misplaced. We don't see any fiscal impact to the bill. The actions which we allude to that they may come to us under, or they may petition us for this contract carriage, that would be the normal course of business. And, you know, we would expect that to be absorbed in our current budget and the current amount of money we collect from the regulatory cost charge.
Okay, I just wanted that clarified.
Yes, ma'am.
Why? Maybe you could answer a question for me. Why did Alaska disallow contract carriage in the past? I mean, we've had these utility lines. Is there a reason what that policy decision was? Why are we here? Why are we changing this?
Senator, that's a very good question, and, you know, I'm kind of an old gaffer, but I'm not sure that I'm that old. I can tell you from discussions with some of the corporate memory within the commission, the Pipeline Act and the Right-of-Way Leasing Act were passed together in 1972, and I believe that the legislature wanted to establish a policy of equal and unfettered access to oil and gas in our state. And the common carrier mechanism appeared at that time to really be an excellent vehicle to avoid any discrimination. It's well to note that that act predates the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Act. I believe that that in terms of gas pipelines, with the specific circumstances around the need to assure delivery of gas, that a contract carriage approach certainly in itself does not establish that discrimination will occur. occur, I believe that having the combination of both vehicles that a pipeline company can approach us under is effective. It is important that the RCA considers each application or proposal for contract carriage in the public interest. And again, the specific circumstances are if you, for example, as a bounding condition, had a group of producers approach you to take up to bring 95% of a pipeline under contract carriage, and there was a huge field that obviously may have more capacity, that wouldn't appear to be in the public interest. But so I think that the devil's in the detail here, and the way that we actually do such a or actually apply such a statute. I maybe drifted a little bit there. I hope that answers your question.
Okay, thank you. We have Senator Elton and Senator Seekins.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I really didn't have a question until he said they had no position. I mean, it just seems to me that the RCA, which deals with difficult decisions all the time, I mean, ought to have a preference, whether it's hot dogs or hamburgers. I mean, and maybe in the answer to your just previous question, Mr. Chair, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it almost sounds as if the argument that was being made was an argument for the common carrier approach. And I guess my antenna just twitched a little bit. I mean, how is it that the RCA, which makes decisions, has no position on the bill? I don't know if there's a response that RCA wants to make to that, but this is a fairly significant public policy issue for somebody to not have a position.
Well, I believe, if I may, through the chair, I regard my responsibility to you to attempt to give you the best factual information possible about possible outcomes of the statute. And I guess if, when pressed, I can say that we do have a position that we feel that these statute changes will still allow us to discharge the public interest, and we see it being able to accommodate and to work with pipeline companies to certificate and bring pipelines into operation. Under either contract carriage or a common carriage.
Okay, Senator Seekers.
First, to address Senator Elton's comment, it doesn't really disturb me to have a state regulatory agency, whose mission seems to me to be to carry out the intent of the controlling statutes, not to make them for us, to say, well, this is a good piece of legislation or a bad one. But what I want to know is, from the RCA standpoint, in terms of the public interest, what do you guys see any downside to the proposed legislation?
Through the chair, Senator Seekins, I see no downside on this legislation. Again, with the caveat that we, as long as we can discharge our responsibility to look at each application and the specific circumstances around it and make the correct determination of how that particular application lives within our statute.
Right, and I appreciate that answer. Now, Mr. Chairman, my next question is, from whomever can answer it, is will this proposed legislation help the state of Alaska to get its resources to market sooner, more efficiently, to be able to put some new money into the coffers instead of just passing around the old money? And so if we have no downside in terms of the public interest, what is the upside? And that'll help me make my second decision on this piece of legislation.
Mr. Strandberg?
The Of course, our mission is to regulate for the public interest, and implicit in that is providing an environment to improve investment, to make as good an investment climate as possible, to protect ratepayer interest. Certainly the dynamics of a gas pipeline under the common carrier portion of the Act does not allow definite, hard commitment for the conveyance of gas, and gas is a commodity, time sensitive. Spoke earlier of the need for having the ability to fulfill contracts, production contracts. And I believe the upside of this legislation would be that contracts, this will increase surety for investors that for a given investment in a pipeline, a pipeline company is actually going to be able to comply with the terms of a contract that it signs for the delivery of gas. I hope that answers your question, sir.
It does. In other words, I see there's a definite upside in terms of encouraging development, a definite upside in terms of increasing surety to be able to get people to put the capital out to build the line, and there's no foreseeable downside. So that does answer my questions. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. You know, we have Ben Schoffman has a rather extensive presentation that he wants to give. And it's the hour is getting late here. And we do also have Mark Myers in the audience, DNR. So, Mr. Schoffman, I'd like to give you some time to give your presentation. And then I would like to maybe open up to a couple of brief questions and then tap the expertise of the oil and gas director. So, do you want to go ahead and give that to us?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. This is my slide pack. I'll try to be brief. There's probably more information there than what's required here at the present time, so I will try to get the high point. And again, I think we've talked about Senate Bill 151 really would give an additional option all pipelines in the state to offer permanent interruptible service. Kind of allows other pipelines to do the same thing with the North Slope gas line was provided to give in the 2000 session. It also very much is consistent with sound policy elsewhere in the U.S. where FERC, since deregulation, has been very accustomed to granting firm and interruptible transportation or contract carriage. And that's one of the reasons that we probably haven't seen this issue arise in Alaska. There's been not a lot of pipeline construction activity since deregulation occurred. And again, this is just very much in line with what's happening elsewhere in the United States. The difference between firm and interruptible service may be obvious, but just to quickly highlight that, what happens in firm service is a shipper agrees to pay a monthly reservation charge for a set level of capacity, which is due and payable whether or not that capacity is actually used. Pipeline in turn guarantees that capacity is available on an as-required or as-needed basis. Interruptible service is only paid by the shipper if and when the service is used. And the pipeline generally makes best efforts to provide capacity, but if it's not available for whatever reason, shipments that are interruptible are, as the name implies, subject to interruption, but most often just curtailment rather than completely being shut off. The bill has two important benefits, and we've kind of talked around those, but for pipeline investors, it gives them the opportunity to understand that there is indeed a demand for the services they're being asked they're investing into, how much, and so forth. So it helps to economically justify that there is a need for a piece of pipe, helps to reduce the risk, the uncertainty of whether or not it's going to be used. It also helps to set at least a minimum level of what people are willing to pay for. In other words, put their money where their mouth is to follow through. So if a pipeline company decides to make an investment, they have some assurance
that there's a level of business out there which will be following on their investment. On slide five, prospective shippers would also like contracts of carriage or permanent interruptible transportation from two levels. One was discussed here just a moment ago. Gas contracts are typically entered into between producers and end users on the same basis, firm or interruptible. And in the event that a producer signs firm supply contract, it doesn't make a lot of sense to insert a pipeline in between the producer and the customer that doesn't have the ability to align its services along with the gas contract. So those with firm gas sales contracts may be more likely to want firm transportation and be willing to pay for that transportation. But those with interruptible supply contracts would be more likely to be biased towards selecting interruptible transportation services. The same token, as also mentioned earlier, gas supplies are another reason. If a producer has firm supply, gas it knows it has available, would like to get to market, it is much more likely to consider the use of firm transportation. On the other hand, if there is a significant uncertainty in those supplies because the wells haven't been drilled or not enough have been drilled yet, then it makes very little sense for them to pay in advance for a service that they may never need. So this, the real key word here is alignment, about aligning gas contracts and transportation services and gas supplies and transportation services. Slide six, the highlights here basically is this does not change the open access status of pipelines under the State Pipeline Act. I agree with Mr. Strandberg's testimony that the RCA still will act in the public interest to make sure that supplies where they are out there will have access to the system, either through making sure that open season processes may be fair or forced expansion if it comes down to it. It will not have an adverse fiscal impact on the state, and it will not have an adverse impact on smaller shippers. As a matter of fact, I think I've already alluded to the fact that we've had conversations with several small shippers, and they like the idea of pipelines being built so that they can be more sure that the exploration efforts they employ, if successful, are going to have some place to go with the gas. That's been the track record so far. Again, I've been able to speak on behalf of Aurora Gas and Forest Oil. I'd say furthermore, RCA is going to be looking at each individual situation, as they will with KKPL, to make sure those smaller producers don't get locked out. It's in the pipeline company's benefit to maximize throughput. They would like more gas running through than less, but there's not really any incentive for them to artificially constrain throughput. And I would say that the other statutes and agencies don't seem to have a concern with producer affiliation. FERC has not prohibited that sort of situation. The 2000 amendments to this bill, or to this legislation in 4206, did not discriminate against that. And in Alaska, there are basically two entities that have built pipelines, and it's the public utilities, like NSTAR, or the producers. Those are the ones with the capital, the resources, and the incentives. I think actually what will happen is we'll see accelerated investments as opposed to less investment by allowing firm and interruptible transportation services to be offered. So our contention is the pipelines are good for business, and I think it will spur activity. Making the ability to do firm and interruptible transportation will give pipeline investors more assurance that the investments they make are going to be efficiently utilized and in demand, and it'll give producers and gas suppliers the ability to ensure that if they have firm gas sales commitments, that they will have the ability to transport that gas to market to ensure they can meet their contracts. I have some information in your package about KKPL. I don't think I need to run through that. The real timeliness issue of this bill comes down to that KKPL does have two tentative contracts for firm shipments of gas, and they would like to offer that service as the pipeline goes into operation later this year. And therefore, it's a very timely urgent issue for KKPL, but we believe it also has great benefits for encouraging pipeline investments and development activities of oil and gas resources.
zones, but that's pretty much what I wanted to say.
Thank you. Mr. Schuffman, you're already a producer, right? So you already know the gas that you want to ship on the pipeline. Why do you need contract carriage?
Is this the chairman I'm addressing?
Yeah.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. In the case of KKPL, Marathon and Unocal have formed a separate pipeline entity, Cashback Pipeline, whose sole business it is to operate, own and operate this pipeline. So it is a standalone business venture that will be regulated again by the RCA. It's in our interest to make sure that that pipeline company we created is not a loser of money, but is financially viable in its own right. So we have attempted to conduct the open season and set up the pipeline tariffs, treating everyone equally, inviting other people to nominate gas or book for services. But the real issue is, because of a variety of reasons, it made the most business sense to set up a separate company for this aspect. And that company, we would like to be have some financial underpinning to it.
Okay, but if you had an open season and invited other people, if nobody else has got gas, then it's kind of a moot point, isn't it?
At the moment it was, but again, I think it was our anticipation that others might have gas. There are other people with leases that direction who had the opportunity to express interest or make commitments. But at least the open season helped us to identify the minimum size line buyer. So in this case, you're right. KKPL's owners have committed to build the pipeline. This is more of an issue, at least in KKPL's stance. Well, it is both an issue for them. We would like this company to be financially stable, but also the producers, Marathon and Unocal in this instance, do have commitments to ship firm gas to various supply contracts, and they would like to be sure that they will have that ability to do so and are willing to pay for it.
Okay, but you can't have, you know, nominate gas if you don't have bookable reserves. I mean, how? So I don't know. I guess I find, all due respect, that, you know, this, while we had a great open season and people could nominate gas, when nobody's drilled, nobody's got any bookable reserves. I mean, it's kind of rings a little hollow with me. But anyway.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, in this instance, it is the fact that there are a bunch of other investments tied to that whole development program, the Nanilchik gas discovery that is the primary supply area for this. There are millions and millions of dollars being spent. It is incumbent upon the suppliers to ensure that millions and millions of dollars being spent is going to result in their ability to ship the gas they believe they are in the process of proving up and are going to be prepared to deliver as early as the end of this year.
Okay. Is the capacity on that, in that gas line 100% at this point, with what you want to ship through there?
You've contracted? Is the gas line completely full?
Yeah, I mean, have you contracted for the full capacity of the pipeline?
No, we are not.
How much, what percentage have we got here?
Well, forgive me for maybe giving a longer answer than what you wish to hear, but the gas line will not come on stream at full capacity, or at least the gas supplies. They will ramp up to a level and then begin to decline. But at its peak rate, the anticipated throughput that's been contracted for is 90 million cubic feet per day. Under a reasonable operating scenario that we are currently considering, that being the inlet pressure of about 1,050 pounds and the outlet pressure of about 750 pounds, the gas line capacity would be in the neighborhood of 120 to 130 million cubic feet per day. So just on that basis, at the very peak, there's about 25%, give or take, excess capacity at the peak at the moment that is not contracted for. And that's not considering that the line could be expanded beyond that if there were other supplies that were proved up and firm commitments were received.
And that would be expanded by either compression or looping, right?
Compression or changing the inlet-outlet conditions, which is the same thing, but the compression could be put at the beginning, at the end, in the middle, but a variety of things. Looping would probably be a last resort, but that's also possible.
Okay. All righty. Well, thank you very much. If nobody else has any questions, Senator Seekins does.
Couple,
couple questions, if I could, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. In terms of, you made a statement earlier that this is a common scenario in other state statutes. How common?
Yes, Senator Seekin, through the chair, this is Ben Shoffman again. I think what I mentioned before, this is common in the lower 48 by FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, over the past couple of decades. So we did take the opportunity to take a look what other gas-producing states, notably Oklahoma, Texas, and Louisiana, were doing. They each have slightly different statutory schemes, but in each of those schemes, one form or another, they do permit gas to be transported on a firm and interruptible basis. So I'm not sure if that fully answers your question, Senator Seekins, but that's the result of our investigation at this point.
That close enough. I'll call that good. The next thing is, as I understand it, as you've just testified, you've built into this the capacity to carry what you feel you're being able to produce, and you're building into it, this pipeline, some flexibility for other producers and allowing them a structured rate process that may be beneficial to help them get their product online and to market. Is that correct?
Senator Seekins, again through the chair, Ben Shoffman. That's essentially correct with this caveat. Being a common carrier or under the common carrier regulations of whether or not we have this contract carriage provision, RCA is definitely concerned about two things. One, making sure there's room for others to get in, but two, making sure that it's not too big. The nature of pipeline design being what it is, as you change from one pipeline size to another, you gain a relatively large amount of incremental capacity. It's not uncommon for nearly a doubling, well, between 50 and 100% change in capacity just by going up a diameter size is not uncommon. So it's pipeline capacity is one of those things that is a function of a lot of factors, but again, when you go from an 8-inch piece of pipe to a 12-inch piece of pipe, it's almost a doubling of capacity that you get rather than just a 10 or 20% increase. So some of it's just the economies of design and how that works, the physical aspects of flow through a round piece of pipe.
And how my final question, if I could, Mr. Chairman, can you tell me, and I realize I'm asking you as the, you know, as an entity owned by two parents, can you tell me if anything in this rate structure that's being proposed in this bill would put a potential competitor with either one of your parents at a disadvantage?
Senator Seekins, again through the chair, I don't see how that would result. The process at the moment that has been gone through is that everyone has been offered the same two options, firm or interruptible transportation. RCA is going to be ruling on a tariff, assuming this bill passes, that sets the rates for how much it costs to transport gas under firm and interruptible transportation. So there will be two different tariffs out there to choose from. Anyone who comes along wishing to assign or contract for those services will know in advance what those rates are. They will be indiscriminatory toward whether or not they're a producer affiliate or an independent. So that will be a completely open process, published information that will be the same whether, for example, if Marathon would do more exploring and needs more firm capacity, we would have to contract with KKPL under the exact same terms, under published rates, and see if that capacity was available.
And that's assuming, of course, that nobody finds more quantities of gas out there than they can ship through the excess capacity.
Again, this is Ben Shoffman through the chair. At the point extra capacity was needed, there would be a new RCA rate case that would have to determine how that capacity would be provided for, what the costs would be, and how those would be equitably placed over the various tariff structures offered at that point in time. In other words, who's going to pay for it?
Well, let's all hope that that situation happens. Gas supplies.
Yeah, we'd like that.
Okay, well, we have Mark Myers here from DNR, and it's had a long day. I'd like to get things wrapped up here. But Mr. Myers, can you come up?
For the record, Mr. Chairman, I'm Mark Myers with the Division of Oil and Gas, and I also have online Kevin Banks and Anthony Scott
okay.
with the Division as well.
Thanks for coming today. Appreciate it. Do you have any testimony, or are you just here to answer questions?
Just here to answer questions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any questions of Mr. Myers? Very often.
At the risk of a glare from the chair, just one. I mean, does DNR have a position on the bill?
to the chair, Senator Elton, DNR does not have a position on the bill.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, if I could ask one question.
Senator Seekins.
Do you see the downside of the upside?
Senator Seekins, the chair, you know, I think contract carriage can, in fact, provide the more certainty that if you have a contract up with a utility, a long-term contract, that you have the pipeline capacity. It can help with the financing. That's the upside. There's a reason for contract carriage. The tricky part is there are some cases where an affiliated pipeline may not have the same motivations as an independent pipeline. An independent pipeline always is generally is going to want to expand. It can pass the rate base on. An affiliated pipeline could reach some circumstances where it's in a competitive situation for that gas market with someone else who has a new discovery and wants to get that gas online. So again, the affiliation can be an issue. However, in this case, when we look at the RCA's authority, it's greater than FERC's. So the RCA can compel expansion. It can help allocate production. It can work out clear rulemaking, and it can put together rules for conducting of open seasons that are generally strengthened, probably to what FERC can do. So we've got more authority. There's a bit of more of uncertainty if you're that explorer. I mean, there is. I think the positive attribute is under contract carriage, it is possible some pipelines might get built that may not under common carrier. So the infrastructure is there. Your ability to get into that infrastructure and affiliation isn't as clear as it would be in a non-affiliated pipeline that's going to want to expand in all cases. I'm not saying that there's anti-competitive behavior going on, but there's the potential concern of those that, you know, make that initial investment, that first open season, that their gas has priority in the marketplace. Could happen. I'm not saying it will again. I'm not saying that Alaska has some sizable more protections with RCA than does in the federal side. On the federal side, the Minerals Management Service has had some problems with offshore pipelines and getting access to those. They're more akin to the Alaska situation than, say, Oklahoma or Texas, where there's lots of competing pipelines, lots of infrastructure built in there. So we're a bit more, the remoteness from Alaska does put a few differences on it. But then again, the RCA has more authority than FERC does in dealing with it.
And one follow-up, if I could, Mr. Chairman. If this was not an affiliated pipeline, if this was simply a common contract carrier, do you think they would be looking for the same kind of flexibility that this pipeline is?
Senator Seekins, the chair, yes, I do. In fact, you know, the contract carriage is a sort of a take-or-pay contract. It helps with the financing, you know, it's for sure. Again, in a affiliated, a producer-built pipeline, I mean, they have a good idea of the gas going into the line, they have the market understanding, and they're self-financing. But in the case someone else would go to the market to try to get financing, the fact that you had contracts locked up for a long period of time, you knew that gas would flow, could help you on getting separate financing for the pipeline.
So, in effect, then, it's really a good flexibility component, whether it's affiliated or not. And we may be, by looking at it as being an affiliated contract, a pipeline, we may be reading more into that than we're just saying this is a common procedure in other places and a better way to get gas to market.
Senator Seekins, through the chair, I think that's basically correct.